Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. In 2012, Washington voters approved Initiative 502. Passage of the measure set in place a licensing and regulation scheme and rescinded state laws criminalizing pot use and possession. It legalized the production, sale, and taxation of small amounts of marijuana-related products for adults 21 and over. In this episode of Speakers Forum, we'll hear about the myriad details entailed in implementing 502. Not surprisingly, there have been rough spots, but overall the transition is moving ahead. By the end of 2014, approximately 100 stores and 320 growers had been licensed in the state. But questions remain. What if the federal government changes its current laissez-faire attitude toward legalization? Do counties have the right to ban sales and grow operations? And what's being done to enforce DUI laws and manage medical marijuana distribution? Last month, Seattle University invited Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson and Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes to talk about how the rollout of 502 is going. The event was moderated by Seattle journalist Joni Balter and Seattle University's Institute of Public Service Director Larry Hubble. This event took place at the SU Student Center on January 28, 2014. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
My name's Larry Hubble. I'm the director of the Institute of Public Service. And welcome to our second in a series, arranged by Joni Balter, our distinguished professional in residence. Tonight, our subject, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, is the legalization of marijuana, the highs and lows. anything for marketing. We have two very distinguished people who we're going to be interviewing tonight. We have Bob Ferguson, the Washington State Attorney General, and also the city attorney, Pete Holmes. We thank you very much for coming to this event. As I said, this is a series of three. We had the mayor here 2 months ago, and on May 11th, we're going to be having another event. And in that event, we're going to have two congressmen, Dave Reichert, Republican, and Adam Smith, a Democrat. So put that on your calendar for May 11th. I'd just like to say one thing that our general counsel told us that he wanted me to say during this event tonight is that although marijuana may be legal to possess in small quantities, at least off campus, it is illegal to have it on campus. So he wanted to make sure that I had said that. So please, our brownies were not spiked with marijuana tonight. But this event, I'd also like to say, is sponsored by the Office of Academic Affairs, the College of Arts and Sciences, and also the Institute of Public Service. And for those of you, I know we have some of our students out there in the audience, those of you who aren't MPA students or in the BPA program, I'd like you to consider this as a program that you might want to enter, because I think we have an excellent faculty. The MPA program especially is very accessible because we offer our classes at night and on the weekends, so it's great for working professionals. So please consider that. And now, I'd like to introduce our dean, who is paying for a good part of this, Dr. David Powers, and he's going to make a few introductory remarks.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's a pleasure to have Larry with us here as the director of the Institute for Public Service, and this is a special treat here tonight. How many of you folks are students here at Seattle University? I'm just curious. That's great. It's great to see you all here. You know, this is neat with the public administration program, the BPA, the MPA, and also folks who are in nonprofit leadership. These are students you guys, I know, are interested in policy, developing law, helping move things forward through that process and also through elections and votes. This is really, I think, a fascinating time to live in Washington State with the votes we've had the past few years, really, I think Pete Holmes said earlier to me, a petri dish for the whole country. Maybe that was Bob said that. A really great opportunity to see real change in action and judge and study what's happening. It's a real pleasure, and I want to make sure and absolutely welcome the Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson and, of course, the City of Seattle Attorney Pete Holmes, tonight. This is a very special opportunity to talk to folks who are in the middle of, I think, one of the most interesting and exciting things to be dealing with, and a whole host of issues. The mayor talked a lot about the minimum wage law raise last time. We're talking here about the new legislation, the new laws around marijuana legalization, a really fascinating opportunity, and a place here at Seattle University where we can engage those. This is real service. Serving in an elected official position, or really anywhere in government, is a real service position, and I appreciate that you students are interested in that. I think Seattle University is a great place to engage with that, and we're really happy to have Joni here teaching a class this quarter on media and government, and bringing these great talks to us here this year. So it's my pleasure to not spend any more time at the mic, as a dean is wont to do, but to go ahead and move forward. Thank you all for being here, and again, thank our guests for being here tonight. Thank you.
Before we start the questions tonight, I just want to tell you that we're going to spend about 45 minutes. Joni and I will be asking questions of our guests here, and then we'd like to turn it over to you. And please be thinking of questions that, you know, we didn't ask. So that'll be at the last part of the program. So, Joni, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. And I also want to say that we will ask questions. We've told them this in advance. We will ask them. Sometimes we'll ask a question we want them both to answer, but sometimes maybe it's just to one. So don't think we forgot somebody there. And I also want to thank you both. We started talking about this event a while ago, and I'm so glad that you both could come and do this. It's a wonderful experience for everybody here. So thanks a ton to both of you. And so as I'll start off with the fact that in November 2012, two states, Colorado and Washington, decided to vote to legalize recreational marijuana. At the time, everybody knew that it was an experiment, that these two states were just kind of acting as laboratories, as states often do, that we would be marching somewhat into the unknown, and we would sort of fix it as we went and things like that, but it is an experiment. So I want to start, I'll start with you, Bob Ferguson. How's the experiment going? What do you think?
Sure. First, thanks so much for having us. It's great to be here at Seattle University, and thanks to all of you for joining us today. And I think you mentioned we're marching into somewhat the unknown. I wouldn't qualify it. I mean, it's a march into the unknown.
Yeah.
It really is a first-time attempt by a government to legalize marijuana on this scale. That's just a fact. So anytime you do something new, I think in government or in business, that's going to be a challenge. I think anytime you do something new on an issue like the legalization of marijuana, that's going to be a challenge. Whether you're for it or against it or agnostic on it, that's going to raise a challenge. And I guess in terms of answering the question directly, how's it going? You know, I'd say overall, all things considered that go into the challenge, yeah, starting from a dead stop, legalization, when you don't have some sister state out there you can model after or learn lessons from how they did, you've got to go through that yourself. Hey, have there been ups and downs? Of course. But overall, I'd have to say it's been a pretty solid. That doesn't mean it's been perfect by any stretch of the imagination. One thing I say a lot, though, is that as a lawyer for our clients, the legislature, boards, commissions, universities, you know, I'd rather take our time and get it right than be in some rush to implement this thing. A lot of states are watching what we're doing. Alaska and Oregon, the District of Columbia, legalized marijuana just last November. So folks are watching how this experiment goes in Washington, Colorado. So it's important to me that we do this in a thoughtful way. I realize folks are impatient. They want to get this thing going, but it's important to try and get it right.
So Pete Holmes, you're flying out tomorrow to Maryland. So other states really are trying to copy us. How do you think the experiment's going? And you were really involved in getting this going in this state.
True. I was a sponsor of Initiative 502. But, you know, before I say another word, I've got to call out the architect. The evil genius of this experiment is Allison Holcomb. Allison, if you could wave.
Will you stand up, Allison? She is the author of Initiative 502. She's here. Thank you.
The evil genius. My genius, of course, is in picking the winner. And so, you know. But Allison and I had worked together on a number of matters, including how to, you know, add some cohesion, some internal logic to the medical marijuana system that had existed long before we even conceived of 502. And so we had some history together on that. The answer to your question, things are going very well here, and I think that we will look back on things like only having a third of the stores open 2 years after the vote, or the product shortages and things like that that have kind of besieged some of the first licensees to get their stores open. We're going to look back on those as kind of a distant memory, and instead, I think we're going to have a much tighter, well-run system that's going to be profitable for the entrepreneurs that are involved, that's going to be something that is really embraced by law enforcement, and it's going to make the community really happy that they shifted, that they took this leap of faith to envision marijuana as something other than a commodity that was, grown and traded and smoked in the shadows, and started to bring this out into the open and just be a little bit more smart, a little more sophisticated in how we talk about substances that are used recreationally.
Well, as we go forward, what surprised you? Like, what didn't you guys see that was coming? And I will start with you, Pete, on that one. Yeah, on the surprises, yeah.
I think we anticipated a lot of what happened. Perhaps the scale might have surprised us, how long.
Scale of interest?
There were a couple of things. Well, how long the onset would be, for instance. One of the objects is, of course, to displace blatantly illegal systems, illegal enterprises that are producing and distributing marijuana with this legally regulated and tax system. So the quicker you can bring on board your legal system, then the more rapidly you can displace the illegal system. And so to the extent that it's taken a little bit longer, then of course there's been a little more attenuated pain involved. And how do you get the illegal market to either go legit or, find another line of work? And all the while being mindful of the medical patients that are out there that really have receive benefit from marijuana, that they have been voices in the wilderness trying to cry out that the Schedule I allocation for marijuana has made no sense whatsoever. And across the country, you may have people say in the 50% or greater range that want to legalize marijuana, but the American public has been in the 80% range for years, recognizing that there are legitimate medical uses for marijuana, and that's one of the things that's kind of kept this hope alive.
We'll go deeper on medical in a minute, but what surprised you, Bob?
I think Pete's answer is a pretty thoughtful one. The only thing I just will add that might be of interest to folks, frankly, more on the personal side on my job, is that while I knew coming into it that it would be a big part of my life as Attorney General, the legalization of marijuana, I have to say I'm a bit surprised by how much of my time is spent on the issue. In fact, if I had to pick one single issue of all the issues which you can imagine that I grapple with as Attorney General, if I had to pick one where I spend the most time on, above all others, it'd be the legalization of marijuana, and that'd be a pretty easy call.
Is that about the banking, or what's
you name the issue, and there's some client of mine who's grappling with that in some way, right? And of course, it's the people of the state of Washington as well, but the legislature, of course, with all their issues, they turn to us for legal advice. The governor, public schools, colleges, right, universities, they have issues related to legalization of marijuana. I mean, you name the board or client, we give legal advice. The Liquor Control Board, which of course regulates the legalization of marijuana. And just the intense media interest as well consumes a lot of our time. So it's one we want to be thoughtful about. The legal advice is in some ways uncharted sometimes, right? There's not a whole lot out there, right? And so just put that in some sense of scale for folks. It's a big part of my time as Attorney General. We have a team who works on it, starting from my chief deputy and on down. We have high-level folks working on it, but it is a big part of my life as well.
I'd like to be a little bit of a contrarian. Let me ask you the question. Does the legalization of marijuana actually encourage more use of it for those people who didn't want to break the law previously?
My honest answer is I don't know. I don't pretend to, by the way, I don't pretend to be some subject matter expert on the legalization of marijuana. I was not involved in the initiative. I'm a lawyer for the state, and that's my focus, and believe me, I got my hands full with that. So on issues beyond that, to be candid, I don't weigh in where I don't have a sort of an expert or fully formed opinion.
He wasn't in line on opening day either.
I didn't see him.
I think the answer, honestly, is it probably does, certainly initially, because the novelty of it. And I think that we've seen suddenly it's legal. Then, of course, the initial question was, where can you buy it legally? And now, that's starting to come online. So I think, to be honest, you have to say initially it probably does. But what we're hoping for is a different culture where some of the forbidden fruit aspect of it is starting to attenuate, where we'd look at this in the same way that we do, you know, a glass of wine after work or over dinner. And I think at some point we will start to get there when the novelty of it starts to wear off and we start to get more realistic about this and treat it as a serious substance and not again in the shadows.
All right. Well, so as the experiment rolled forward, you've thought to yourself, we got to make some fixes here. I want to skip the medical marijuana for a minute. We'll come back to that in a little bit later. But what things would you change? You know, we were just sort of setting a course. There's some things that probably do need to be changed. Do you have any thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, one thing I'm not sure about the state or the federal level, but the federal level, there are some major things that would need to change. I'll just throw that out there to get the conversation going. And one example, you sort of referenced it indirectly earlier, was the banking issue, right? That we do not want the legalization of marijuana to be a cash industry, right? For all sorts of obvious reasons from a public safety standpoint as well. However, banks, as you know, under federal law, the possession, any proceeds from the sales of a illegal drug transaction creates problems in the bank industry. And under federal law, of course, it's illegal to buy or sell marijuana. Banks are understandably cautious about taking the proceeds of a marijuana sale when marijuana possession sales illegal under federal law. To be candid, this you asked about surprises earlier. This wouldn't be a surprise, but a disappointment for me has been that in the past 2 years, as I think Washington and Colorado have moved forward in a pretty thoughtful manner on this thing, trying to do it the right way, I don't think we've had nearly the assistance from the federal government that I had hoped for to provide safe havens for banks, for example, to take the proceeds of those legal sales under state law so banks can take those so we get out of that cash industry. So that's one example where, I'm just being honest, I've been disappointed. I've written letters. We've had conversations. When I go back to D.C. to meet with our congressional delegation, the change just hasn't come in the way that I think is really necessary for the growing number of states that are legalizing marijuana.
So, but what happened on the banking thing is Congressman Denny Heck tried to get some relief on that, and it just didn't really happen.
That's exactly right. There have been efforts out there. There have been proposals. Yes. Some that got a little further than folks anticipated, but it's not cleared Congress. And that's really unfortunate. I'm sorry, whatever you think of legalization of marijuana, right? And I realize there's two sides of the issue. I think we should all agree that in states where it is legalized, there should be a place for the proceeds to go where folks aren't carting around an awful lot of cash, right? That's not good for anyone. And so that's been a big disappointment from my standpoint.
And for you, what would you change? What would you have done differently just with the benefit of hindsight?
You know, I guess we're looking at it in some of the recommendations for this session of the legislature. One of the ways that we can kind of, in a backhanded way, address some of the banking problems, at least with the IRS, there's a proposal to collapse the taxing structure of 502 and to make it a point of sale tax so that the proprietors can actually claim it as a consumer tax rather than an excise tax that they technically can't deduct from their from their expenses.
So do you want to explain that currently we tax it?
Right now, there's an IRS rule 280E, so if you're filing your tax return for your I-502 store, the taxes that you've paid as a retailer to the producer or the producer processor are technically cannot be deducted because they are, you know, they were derived from a controlled substance. So they actually pay a tax on a tax, and it could, you know, really ruin their profits and their tax returns. But by making it a point of sale consumer tax, we can do that at the state end and then effectively allow them with through their accountants to claim the tax in a way that's not going to reduce their profits. Let's see, there was one other.
I want to throw one out that you mentioned to me before for a piece of journalism I was doing. What about the no smoking in public? Right now, just so everybody knows, you are not allowed to smoke in public. You are not even allowed to smoke in view of public. So for a piece I did for Bloomberg View, you had some thoughts about that.
The smoking in public thing has been near and dear to me. I was going to see if they wrote P.D. Holmes on my on my badge here, but you know, I think that one of the things we tried to relay, the theme throughout all of this is to try and get people to imagine life after prohibition. You know, prohibition is the problem, right? Prohibition was the wrong-headed, ridiculous rule. We kept doing over and over again the same stupid thing, expecting a different outcome. And so to try and really get people to take that leap of faith, one of them was to say that, you know, we don't you couldn't walk down the streets of Seattle and not expect, if you were carrying an open can of beer, that you run a good chance that someone's going to stop you and maybe even write you a ticket on that. That's just not accepted, that just be drinking in public. And the same should apply to use of marijuana. And so that's why 502, I think, very wisely said, this does not sanction public use, open use and display. And the question, though, is how do you deal with that? And we went the civil sanction route, that, you know, a civil infraction, not an arrest, would be issued. And it's going to take a little while to, I think, turn the culture, to get people to accept that, you know, this is a new right, a right and freedom that was hardly fought for and won. Please don't screw it up. Get on board, right? Just let's all. There's no reason for you to impose on, you know, families in a park that are trying to enjoy a little bit of fresh air. You've got this new right. Guard it, safeguard it. And so we're going to turn it.
I'd like to ask you a question more broadly about the initiative process. Do you think that the initiative process makes for better or worse public policy?
And you can start with 1351. Just kidding. Okay.
The issue of what?
The initiative process. Do you think that, generally speaking, right?
I'll try a first shot at it. It's that's a hard question to answer, obviously, but a couple things to keep in mind is that, number one, Washington has a long history of being a very populist state, and the initiative process is a part of that. And I get that folks have a lot of issues with initiatives. When I was in private practice, before running for public office, a big part of my time as a lawyer was spent being part of a legal team that challenged many of Tim Eymann's initiatives once they were passed. Successfully, I might add, each time, okay? So I understand the downsides, right, or the pitfalls of initiatives I think are poorly worded, not well thought out, and terrible public policy and unconstitutional on top of all that, okay? So that said, Washington does have this history of being a populist state, and that ultimately the people having that ability, like the legalization of marijuana, I think is in many respects a good example of that, where, the politicians were not moving on it, and they weren't going to move on it, right? And you have the ability, we have the ability to go directly to the people. I realize warts and all, right, it's not a perfect process, but to be perfectly candid, I'm not sure I'd change it, right? And that's as someone who's been on the, like I said, on the legal side, challenging those initiatives I had very strong views about. And now my job, of course, as Attorney General, is to defend initiatives, whether I support them or not personally, right? So challenges to it, of course. But I think overall, even with those huge challenges, I don't think I'd change it. And it's part of the culture of the state, I think, as well.
I guess I support it ultimately, provided that we pay attention to campaign finance, because I do believe that the voters are smart enough, when presented with both sides in a clear and coherent and fair manner, will reach the right decision. That was true with 502. And I think that even though some of the pandering that went on by the initiatives filed by he who shall not be named, I try not to even give him that coverage. I think at the end of the day, it's really where you do get some genuine, really big moves in public process. It happened in Colorado, and it happened here. And I don't think legalization, when I ran for city attorney in 2009, if you told me we were going to legalize marijuana in my first term in office, I said, what are you smoking? You know, and but for the initiative process, it would not have happened. And we're really going to turn a corner on this insane war on drugs.
If I can add just one quick thing on that, and that is, I don't want to suggest that, hey, no changes are appropriate. So, for example, there's a proposal, I think right now at the state legislature, that if you want to propose an initiative that's going to have a fiscal impact on the state, you must also include what you would cut from the state budget to fund what you want to do. I haven't seen the legislation, but that concept strikes me as one that I'm interested in, right? Because I'm not a legislator, but I can imagine, because I talked to them about it, right, and the governor as well, the frustration of, hey, you get this big bill from the taxpayers. Well, how do you want us to fund this thing? That's not easy, right? So I'm not sure. I haven't seen the legislation. I'm not sure exactly how you do it, but I think there are some ways to maybe even improve the process that we have.
And that bill is in response to what I just referenced a minute or two ago.
Yes.
Initiative 1351, if you all know, was the class size measure that was proposed to reduce class sizes, but it didn't have any money with it. And it passed by, like, what is it, 50 point something. And it really, I was in Olympia yesterday talking to the two budget writers who are super, super freaked out by how much that thing costs. And so that is what it spawned, the idea of maybe we need to say, here's not only what it costs, because they passed that a few years ago, but here's how we'd be able to pay for it.
Right.
So that.
I just got to say, I do worry, though, about that, the idea that you have to show the cost, the offsetting cost, because we live in a state with, if not the most regressive tax structure, it is pretty close to the top. And that almost just guarantees that you continue to shortchange education, mental health, and everything else. Fortunately, 502 came with its own revenue source.
So we'll move to Colorado here for just a quick second. So Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper recently said, it was in the fall, that it was reckless for Colorado to legalize recreational marijuana. And he actually urged other states to wait for more data, for more information about this before they proceed. Now, he said that when he was running for re-election, and two states, Alaska and Oregon, had it on the ballot. But I just want to know what both of you think about that. We're saying we're doing okay. He's saying it was reckless. Now, I know, in fact, also he was against it from the beginning. So that's just the footnote I want to put in that.
You're just asking our thoughts about what he had to say about.
Yeah, what he said.
I'll just be honest. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I mean, what he's got to say about Colorado. I'm just going to be directly honest. I mean, really, it's. I mean, each state really has. I had an interview with the Oregonian newspaper not too long ago, just before it went to their voters. And, you know, what I said there is, look, each state has is going to have its own challenges, right, by the way the law is written. The court battles that will ensue, we'll probably talk about some of those before we're done. Each state has its own challenges. That's my sense of it. And having spent a lot of time talking to elected officials in Colorado, because we compare notes on a regular basis, but in terms of what one governor thinks about what's going on in that state, to be honest, I guess I don't spend much time thinking or worrying about that.
Well, Pete does spend some time thinking about Colorado, so what's your... thought on that?
Well, a couple of trips to Colorado as well, as, you know, during the campaign and after. You know, the two states did take two different approaches. Colorado was Amendment 64. It was a constitutional amendment that required that the legislature work and kind of fill in the interstices, add things like the DUI provision that 502 included from the outset. They also had a much more robust medical marijuana system in place. Ours had been decimated by a gubernatorial veto in 2011, and so we essentially had unregulated medical marijuana system that our courts of appeal have said is essentially nothing more than an affirmative defense. There is no regulation for medical marijuana. And again, that's the courts, that's not me. And so when you compare what was going on in both states before they flipped the switch in Colorado and here in Washington, we really had to build a system from the ground up. And I think as a consequence, we're not going to experience the same problems that Colorado has had. I don't think we're going to have Maureen Dowd, excuse me, coming and eating too much of a marijuana-infused chocolate bar. I think we've been able to learn from some of those mistakes. And I also think they're going to have a difficult time with their medical system is so liberal in the sense that what they're allowed to grow at home. And frankly, I've been in some of the white glove, the premier establishments in Denver, and walk up to the owners and see these beautiful facilities. They've got a medical counter on one side and a recreational counter on the other. And the owner, they're talking to a collection of municipal attorneys from around the country, said openly that, you know, only tourists and chumps go to the recreational counter where you pay full tax. He said, sometimes we'll ask if you've got your medical card on the other, but no one checks us to see if we're checking. So I think they've got, they've not seen the revenues that they've wanted to see, and they're going to have a more difficult time reining that in than Washington will.
Bob, you just recently came out for raising the banning tobacco for people under the age of 21. Do you see any relation to this in the pot issue?
It's interesting. I do on a certain level. So just to be clear, as Attorney General, I can request legislation from the state legislature, right? So it goes through the normal legislative process, but the legislators know it's legislation requested by the Attorney General. So just announced a proposal to raise the smoking age for tobacco products to 21 to purchase and use of it. And in making the argument, one thing I did say is that, look, you have to be 21 for alcohol. The voters just approved 21 as the age for marijuana. That there is a logic to me that that we have some consistency there. And I think if you were starting out in all three products, I don't think anyone would say, well, let's have two of them being at 21 and one of them being at 18, right, to be honest. So I don't think went much further than that in terms of it, but I did note the fact that the voters just approved this for marijuana, and 21 was the age. I think that's an appropriate age. It seemed to make sense to me for smoking to go to 21. We would be, by the way, the first state in the country to go to 21. Four states have 19. A number of local jurisdictions have 21, but we'd be the first state to go to 21.
Do you have a thought about that?
Not really. It's probably, I think that's one area where the government does make sense, the protection of youth and making sure youth access of harmful products is limited. It's when we then ban everything for all adults as well out of an abundance of caution that I think we stray from our central government mission.
So let's go to the medical marijuana situation in our state. You described Colorado. They have the same store with two different counters. Here in Washington, our measure didn't really discuss medical marijuana. So we now are on our third attempt, am I correct, in the legislature to kind of fix it. And what I mean by fix it is there has always been a goal to get these two industries to kind of work together and for recreational really to be for recreational, for medical to really be for people who really need the medical product. Give us an update, and what do you think is going to happen there?
Of the two major bills that have been talked about in the legislature, I think the main issue that was written about in the Times, it's online tonight, and I think you'll see it in tomorrow's Dead Tree Edition, the question...
It's no way to talk, by the way.
The question is whether we should have universal home grows. And so that's
universal.
Kind of universal home grows. So in other words, you don't need to have a medical card, but
for
anyone,
recreational,
any adult 21 and over could grow marijuana at home, very limited amount. The importance being that it be a limited amount so that law enforcement could easily distinguish between a personal home grow and a commercial amount. So that probably with the party in charge in the Senate is probably not going very far, but it was proposed by Senator Caldwell's. The main point, though, is to really fold medical marijuana into the 502 system so that medical products are made available to patients as well as adults without a medical card that we know is licensed, is tested, and is safe. And, you know, we can continue with some sort of authorization system so that someone under 21 needs to buy product could do so, or if you want to extend a tax benefit to medical patients. Those are really the only reasons you need to go forward, provided you're making sure you've got the good product and advice available.
And I guess I'll take on this. I think the second question you asked was, what's going to happen, sort of the prediction.
Yeah,
and,
what do you expect?
And so I'll take a shot at that side of it, and that is that I think there's a very good chance, a very high likelihood that one of these proposals, or there's a lot out there right now, and things are going to change and evolve through the session. But I do think that the legislature is very focused on the issue that Pete mentioned of bringing the systems together. And I would be surprised if a legislative proposal did not get approved in this session along those lines. The details, of course, right, that's what they're going to be discussing. But it's my sense that the legislature believes it's important to address this issue in this session. So that's my sense of what will happen.
Why do you think that the recreational stores don't advertise the fact that they have a regulated product as opposed to the medical market for marijuana? Why do you think that the recreational stores don't advertise the fact that they have a regulated product as opposed to the medical marijuana stores that are completely unregulated?
Because 502 strictly limits their ability to advertise on purpose.
So let's get into the fun little debate between three of you here about whether cities and counties should be allowed to opt in or out. In other words, just so everybody knows what this lingo means, in Washington, the initiative was silent on whether jurisdictions, cities, counties, could just say, we don't want marijuana. We don't want to have stores here. We're not going to allow them. We're not going to zone for them. We're just not going to have them. So there is a legal dispute underway. Pete Holmes described it as, it's the fourth quarter. There's 3 minutes left. It's pretty much decided. Does that sound familiar to anybody? But So can you explain, Bob Ferguson,
sure.
I think you should explain why we don't agree on this.
You bet. I'll take a few minutes for a little more background. So number one, Joni laid it out pretty well. I just want to make sure everybody's clear. The question is whether local jurisdictions, of course, can ban the sale of marijuana. They cannot ban someone's possession and use of marijuana regardless, right? That remains constant around the state. The question is whether a local city or a county can say, you know what, yes, of course, folks can possess and use it, but we don't want to have anyone selling it in our city or county. That's the issue. A number of cities, dozens, were actually choosing to opt out around the state. As a result, the Liquor Control Board, one of my clients, asked me to give a legal opinion on that subject, which my office is asked to give from time to time. So that's a legal opinion. It's not a policy analysis. It's what's the state of the law on whether or not local jurisdictions can opt out. In Colorado, you can opt out. Oregon, Alaska also have embedded in their initiative abilities for jurisdictions to opt out as well. Washington's did not say anything about it. In fact, it's that silence, in my view, that in part led to my legal opinion that local jurisdictions could opt out of the sale of marijuana if that's what they chose to do, that they had that legal authority. That was not a popular legal opinion in many quarters, which I understand. However, I'm confident it's the right legal analysis. And without going too much in the legal analysis, it's basically local jurisdictions have broad authority to set rules and ordinances as they see appropriate. They're close to the people. The state gives them broad discretion. Unless, and it's an important exception, I'm oversimplifying a bit, but unless the state very specifically says, hey, local jurisdictions, you must do X or you can't do Y. Okay, that's preempting the usual local control. Read the initiative. It doesn't say, local jurisdictions, you must sell marijuana. And to be candid, a single sentence would have done it. All local jurisdictions must provide for the sale of marijuana, period. I'm not making this up. If that was in the initiative, okay, that does it. That's pretty clear. That language simply isn't there. Controversial at the time, but there have been a number of lawsuits now where local businesses are suing jurisdictions that have opted out. The state has intervened, become a party to all those lawsuits to represent our view of what the state law is. All five judges who have looked at it in different parts of the state have all ruled that local jurisdictions can ban marijuana, have agreed with my opinion. That said, the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, will have the final view on that, but all five judges who have looked at it have agreed with my opinion that local jurisdictions can ban marijuana if they want to.
Pete, you sat up sort of tall when he started talking, so what's it about?
Because it is an area that Bob and I disagreed on the analysis, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. He does have, it's 5-0 on Bob's side as far as court decisions. But, you know, the reason it's not, for me, an overtime situation is because, first of all, the Supreme Court will rule on this if the legislature doesn't deal with it as a practical matter, and that's probably the best thing that should happen. The legislature could do a number of things. But the reason that I don't, this is not offensive or philosophically repugnant or anything, is because, frankly, as a city attorney, there are so many times when the state asserts preemptive rights that are just terrible. A perfect example is the National Rifle Association has gotten 30 states that by going to state legislatures and saying, all you got to do is enact this little rule and those liberal cities in your state will not be able to do anything about additional gun regulation. And consequently, Seattle, we went all the way to the Supreme Court trying to enforce a ban on bringing handguns to parks and playgrounds where children are. And we were precluded from doing that because of state preemption. So that's why, to me, this is not the end of the world. And when the shoe is on the other foot, frankly, I would rather see there be no state preemption. So I do hope that the legislature will address it. And if they don't, then we'll still see how the Supreme Court comes out on it.
And if I can add just one more, what I think is a really important point on this, which goes to actually the future, whether marijuana will remain legalized in Washington State or around the country as well, is that it may seem a stretch. Well, how can a local ban, how could that potentially threaten legalization or not in general? And here's how that works, is some of those cities who have said, we don't want to have to sell marijuana, when sued and when they've gone to court, they've made two arguments. Their first argument is, we don't have to sell marijuana because basically Ferguson's opinion is right. The initiative doesn't require us to. But they say, if we're wrong on that, okay, if Pete's analysis is correct, if they're wrong on that the state compels us to sell marijuana, well, then our second argument, our alternative argument is, well, in that case, federal law preempts state law, right? you see where this is going, right? Federal law makes legalization, possession, sale of marijuana illegal. They say, well, that then preempts state law. That issue can only be resolved ultimately in our federal courts and ultimately by our U.S. Supreme Court, okay? I'll ask all of you to ask yourselves whether our current U.S. Supreme Court, how they would rule on that issue. But I'm just saying in all seriousness, right, that my legal opinion was a legal opinion. It's not a policy analysis, none of that. That said, if you want the legalization of marijuana in this state, you want local bans. State of Colorado understood that. State of Oregon understood that. State of Alaska understood that. If you don't, if you force those jurisdictions to sell marijuana, you will, I promise you, you will end up in federal court, and you will ultimately end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. And they won't just be deciding for Washington State. Whatever they decide will be decided for the entire country. So just keep that in mind when you're thinking about those local bans. It's a critical, critical issue to the future of the legalization. That said, our view, of course, is federal law does not preempt state law, okay? And that's my job to defend the initiative. But just keep that ultimately in mind of where this thing's going to end up potentially.
Since we have the author of 502 here, would you like to add briefly some
not
of
too
your
wonky,
own?
Though.
So I see now, Joni, why it was so important that I come tonight. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And I will try to keep it really brief. Obviously, American Civil Liberties Union thought very long and hard about the arguments that are being made by our Washington State Attorney General. I will say that if it was required that every state law that was passed include a sentence that said that cities and counties had to follow state law, we would be having a different conversation. That is not the way that the Washington State Constitution works. The Washington State Constitution and the structure of our Washington state government is that the cities and counties are political subdivisions of the Washington state government. When the Washington state government passes a law that says that our state agencies are going to license Washington marijuana businesses, then cities and counties don't get to say, no, you can't. We have a Washington State Liquor Act that includes an opt-out provision that says that if cities and counties don't want to follow Washington state law, that they actually have the option of asking the voters in the city and county to pass an initiative at the local level that allows them to ban the sales of alcohol in their jurisdictions. We examined that, we considered that, we tested voter positions on that when we drafted Initiative 502 and found that Washington state voters actually opposed legalizing marijuana with an option to opt out. And so therefore we did not include it. The way that the Washington state constitution works is not that you have to tell cities and counties that they can't opt out of following state law. They actually have to follow state law. And although we are citing five court decisions that have ruled in favor of the Washington State Attorney General's position, they've been trial courts. And Division II of the Court of Appeals has recently ruled in an analogous situation that, in fact, counties can't opt out of following Washington state law regarding biosolids. So ultimately, the Washington State Court of Appeals may decide this. It's possible the legislature will decide it, but I think we have to be realistic about what the budget situation is for the government right now. They're not inclined to share tax revenues with cities and counties because they have to fund K-12 education. They have to fund a crisis in mental health. And so they're not particularly incentivized to say to cities and counties, okay, we'll buy your compliance with state law. Okay. So I think that although I agree with Pete that it would be cleaner if the legislature simply said, fine, we'll include that sentence that the Attorney General thinks that we need to get the cities and counties to follow state law. But in doing that, we will be taking away resources from our children. We will be taking resources away from mental health. And I don't think they're going to do that.
I'm going to jump in here now because of time. Excellent points. Thank you so much. Did you want to respond, or can I move to another subject just for time purposes?
Sure, I think I could spare everybody sort of a legal debate
between
Allison and myself.
I'll
just say this, that with respect to that argument, and Allison was critical of my opinion when it came out and said the courts would quickly reverse it. All five judges in five different courts around the state have agreed with my analysis. Not only that, every one of them ruled from the bench. In other words, not one of them said, I need to sleep on this, which judges tend to do. They all ruled, they heard the argument, and they ruled from the bench. So it's 5-5. I'm not saying something couldn't change, but I'm confident that the state Supreme Court will ultimately uphold the legal opinion that we outlined on it.
Okay, so I am moving right along here. You mentioned the situation with the federal government, and as most people know, and if you don't, I'll just say it, as you know, pot is illegal in the eyes of the federal government. And when they wrote their letter in August of 2013, I believe it was, when they said they would not intervene, they essentially let the experiment roll. I think President Obama was even quoted at the time saying he had a couple more things on his plate that he had to do. And so I'd like to sort of hear about how the two states are doing with some of the requirements that were placed by the federal government. In other words, the federal government said, we won't come after you if you make sure pot is not easily available to minors, was one of them, if you don't leak across state lines. Well, Nebraska and Oklahoma, if I'm not mistaken, have sued Colorado on the same point. So are they leaking? Are they violating it?
So a couple thoughts there on this. So I guess taking that last one first. So that's right. These two states have sued the state of Colorado, saying that, hey, that they have to deal with the implications of the legalization in Colorado. Couple things. When that ends up in the courts, just so folks here know, we will make sure that my office is filing briefs in that opinion and make sure that we are supporting Colorado. Okay, that this is a I am confident that the arguments of those two states will go nowhere. Okay, and I'll be doing my part to make sure that the voice of Washingtonians is heard in that as well. Number two, yes, that letter does outline like seven areas of concern, might have been the word they had, something like that. And you mentioned a couple, eight of them, thank you. And I think I've got to be careful what I say. I give legal advice to my clients, but what I can say is that since that letter has come out, myself, Pete, the U.S. attorneys in the Eastern District and Western District, the governor, hey, we're on calls, we're talking all the time about, hey, how can we meet those concerns laid out by the federal government, which I think are perfectly reasonable and legitimate. We don't want marijuana in the hands of young children. That's why the Liquor Control Board has taken great pains to codify some rules about the packaging, for example, of marijuana to make sure it's child resistant, to make sure you don't have packaging that's appealing to kids. I've got six-year-old twins, right? When they see a brownie or a cookie, they know what to do. Consume it, right?
Me too. That's,
right?
Me too.
Right? So, we have an interest in getting this right, right? And so those concerns, I think, are concerns. I guess the one thing I just want to make sure folks know is that we spend a lot of time thinking about this. I have communications with the AGs of Oregon and Idaho on a regular basis, talk about our borders, make sure we have lines of communications open, and that we're all coordinating our efforts together. So I think those are legitimate concerns, and we're working on them.
Pete, what do you know of that? Is Washington leaking?
Not to my knowledge, and moreover, if it's over the southern border, they've just legalized marijuana as well. So we're not bordered by states all around that that are trying to maintain prohibition. So we don't have that problem. And I also think that some of the earlier things we said, provided we get medical marijuana reconciled with the recreational system in 502, I think that we're going to be able to meet those eight requirements in the in the federal government's August 29, 2013 memo. So that's one of the things that guides me when I talk to the legislature about what I think is needed to make sure the 502 system works. I'm thinking about that federal government. We don't know who's going to be the next administration. Remember, you do not have a change in federal law yet. You have essentially the Attorney General has exercised prosecutorial discretion. It's important everyone understands that. Bob and I can decide if we're going to charge a crime or not in a given case or, programmatically even. And he and I will no longer be in our respective offices Sunday, just like Eric Holder is going to be gone and perhaps a new administration. So the law needs to be changed. You know, when I came to office January 1, 2010, I stopped prosecuting all misdemeanor cases of possession because it was a stupid law. And I decided, though, we also have to... You have to change the law because I'm not going to be the city attorney forever. And it's only in Seattle, and so we wanted to spread that. So I think that we need to do our best to follow those guidelines. That gives us the best chance for a long-term change, a permanent elimination of the war on drugs.
Go ahead.
Okay, but are we in this state establishing really a dangerous legal precedent by having a state law that runs contrary to federal law?
I guess I'll take that challenging question first. So Look, the way I look at it is states are the laboratories of democracy, right? And that I think in many respects states should be encouraged, right, to affect change as they see appropriate. And other states can look and say, hey, is that great for them? I mean, you look at the range of issues, legalization of marijuana, marriage equality, thankfully, right, spreading like wildfire across the country and throughout the courts as well, right? Far faster than any politicians would ever have done, right? Let's be honest about that. So from my standpoint, is there challenges inherent in that? From a legal standpoint, you bet. I've outlined some of those earlier, right? But that said, I think it's sort of the beauty of the democratic process where states, through in this case the initiative process, are able to move forward. Challenges, but I think it's working for us right now.
It's just important to remember it is by definition a federal system. It's a, you know, there are two levels of government, and it's not intended that even when we talk about the supreme law of the land in the federal constitution, that it means it completely eliminates the state's abilities to deal with their own issues closer to home. It's only if we're in positive conflict with the federal constitution that we actually have an issue. But we're no more required to enforce the federal Controlled Substances Act than we are, you know, adopting uniform federal regulations with regard to alcohol.
And I should add, I want to make sure, I'm being very clear, that I don't view our marijuana laws being in direct conflict with federal law. There's sort of legal analysis there that goes into in terms of, hey, that preemption argument I mentioned earlier, but I do believe if we have to address that preemption issue, we certainly will be arguing that federal law does not preempt Washington state's law, and we think that's a legal argument that we can win in the courts.
We're going to ask one more question, and then we're going to open it up to you. And Danielle and Lindsay will be having microphones, so be ready with your questions. We got, I guess, the mic's up here. So.
Okie dokes. So one thing I think that we should discuss just for a minute here is your employment law situation. There may have been some confusion, or maybe it just wasn't discussed that much, but Initiative 502, help me out here, does not change employment law. So in other words, cities and Boeing, I imagine, and many other places can still drug test and can still do what they did before about employing you. Bob, would you want to just elaborate a little bit on that?
I think that's an accurate summary of this. Yeah, to say the law. I'm not just, yeah.
All right.
I can anticipate the next question.
No, I'm not doing it.
You know, there are a lot of things in our regulatory framework that need to catch up to new realities. And the drug-free workplace rules were left untouched by 502 for a reason, to allow us to, you know, gradually onboard these new systems. You know, currently our law is only worried about present inebriation. There's some differences if you're in an occupation where you're required to have a commercial driver's license and the like, where we're a little more stringent. But if someone goes home and has a bottle of wine over the weekend with dinner, and you go to work completely unimpaired on a Monday, no employer thinks anything of that. And if you do the same thing with marijuana over the weekend, you unfortunately can be, you would still be carrying carboxy THC in your bloodstream that a few days later. And if the employer were to do a random drug test and trip you up on that, in fact, the courts have very clearly said that it's still within the right of the employers to fire you, to terminate you for failing a drug test when there's no present impairment. So, you know, I think that those rules are going to need to catch up with the reality, just like, you know, the cultural ethos about how, whether you can smoke in public or not, whether you know, it's appropriate to go to a store and buy marijuana as opposed to from your corner drug dealer. I think all of those things are going to catch up.
Okay. See, Danielle's going to be on one side of the room and Lindsay's going to be on the other side. So if you just please come up if you have any questions.
Ask away.
Sure. Yeah. So we have the marriage equality thing like you spoke about, where it seems to be rulings are more coming down from the Supreme Court rather than the rather than Congress. Do you see that this is probably going to be an issue for marijuana as well, where you're going to get rulings from the bench to change federal law rather than going to see actual congressional change, legislative change?
I think that congressional change, if it comes, is glacier pace. I mean, I wish it was otherwise. I want to be really clear. I write letters. I want change at the federal level. I just don't see it happening anytime soon. In terms of the courts, I mean, the only I shouldn't say the only, the concern I outlined where that issue of federal preemption can end up in the federal courts, right? I think that's an area of concern. It's sort of a narrow one, that particular path. I don't think it's one you'll see in the other states because they allow the local bans, right? So there's no motivation for a local government to say, make that federal preemption argument because they have the ability to opt out if they want to. So no, I guess I don't see it as primarily a sort of court-driven process with that potential exception that I mentioned. And I do hope that that Congress, as time moves on, takes a more in-line view on this.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath on that, but just a real quick addition is just to make sure that you understand that the reason we care about federal law, it's not that they're going to come in and get an injunction, Washington, you can't legalize it. What they'll do is just enforce federal law separately so that, you know, Cannabis City has DEA come in and seize all their product and take them away in handcuffs. That could happen. The memo, the guidance of August 2013 suggests that at least now, under the present administration, it's not going to happen. But under a Mitt Romney administration, I don't know.
And that's a really good point, is that, that August memo from last year, I forget the exact phrasing, but it said, hey, the federal government's not going to enforce federal marijuana laws at this time. Remember those three words, time, right? So, you know, my spidey senses tingle at that, right, at this time. What that means is, hey, this or, more like, a future administration could have an entirely different perspective on this, right? And so I think that is why it's especially important that sort of goes back to those original questions about how we're doing and making sure we're thoughtful, doing it the right way, keeping out the hands of kids. Those are critical questions because a new administration is going to come, and it's important that that we're able to demonstrate, along with the other states, that we're doing this in a thoughtful, careful, safe way.
I understand there are some smaller banks that are providing banking services. And I might add that when I made my purchase on July 7 or 8, I used
your famous purchase,
a U.S. bank debit card. You know, so like it or not, a national bank was involved in a marijuana transaction.
But the state also has a bank that is handling the taxes or the proceeds, right? The revenue coming into the state.
I believe that is. I think to what extent? I guess I'm not sure. One proposal that is kind of out there. It's been out there for a while. I think it's Bob Hasegawa, a state legislator, has proposed a state bank for a number of years. And I recall. I hope I get this right, but I'm pretty confident. Last year, he mentioned that one additional benefit of a state bank would be that when it comes to the proceeds of marijuana, that the state could say, "Hey, we're going to accept those and do it that way." So that is another sort of proposal that's out there. That's been out there for a number of years. The willpower folded for the state bank? I mean, I guess all I can say is, look, I'm not a legislator, so I don't pretend to have details, but it's not passed in the past, right? I think North Dakota has a state bank. I'm not an expert. They may be the only state that has a state bank. I'm seeing a couple nodding heads, so maybe I've got that right. So it's been done in North Dakota, I think now for a number of years, so it's not impossible. It just hasn't passed yet.
I'm now thinking of the radio broadcast. KUOW is broadcasting this. And so if you have a question, can you please come up to get to the microphone? Because your voice will be just a little lower than it could be. So come up to the microphone. You can line up. That would be a good way to make sure we get a good sound on it.
Just a quick question about your projections about the new initiatives for the emerging industries, such as food production, the smoking lounges, hotels. Delivery services, any of the new projections you guys got?
A couple of comments. Delivery services I don't see being authorized in the current legislature, although I do think that there are good arguments that it could be a public safety measure to actually deliver cannabis rather than having someone go buy it, consume it, and drive. So I think that in a future legislature, they probably will consider that. And as far as vape lounges, I think the city of Seattle will move forward with that. The idea is that if you're going to ban people from smoking in public, make sure they have a place to do it.
Do you want to explain vape lounges?
It's an idea is that, you know, since you can't use marijuana in the open in plain view of the public, the idea is that a for-profit model where you could allow smoking, probably using vaporizers, would be permitted, licensed by the city. Now, the interesting problem, and it goes into the tourism issue, is that it's not so much 502 that we're worried about. That's what establishes the open use and display prohibition. Where we run into problems are with the Clean Air Act, the indoor smoking ban. That's why, you know, we're considering vaporizers as one means of dealing with that. Under the indoor smoking ban, however, existing hotels can designate up to a quarter of their rooms as smoking rooms under existing law. So the Hotel Association is quite interested in how marijuana tourism might play out in Seattle. So we're trying to help give some guidance there. It was one of the interesting little kind of carve-outs that we discovered while looking into vape lounges.
Hi. My question has to do with employment. And I was wondering if, I don't know what the current policies are, but if the city or the state have plans to be leaders in changing employment policies on marijuana, or similar to how you stop prosecuting misdemeanor marijuana, if you have any policy changes coming forward to sort of lead the way of making those changes in the city or for city or state employees.
I'm not aware at the state level what proposals are out there. I'm not suggesting there's not conversations going on, but I've not been a part of those.
Yeah, I guess one kind of mismatch I can mention is that, well, there's a couple. One is, of course, you know, you're a juvenile under the law between 18 and you're an adult after you're 18, but you can't have possess marijuana until you're 21. So right now there's still a bit of a gap where there's a mandatory minimum jail sentence. If you're 20 years old and are, you know, found to be in possession of even less than 28 grams, and there's a mandatory jail sentence that goes with that under current state law. We've asked the legislature to consider aligning those. It's not an issue in Seattle, but again, that's just one prosecutor. So we hope to get that aligned in state law. The other is there's a minor difference. I don't think this is really going to be a practical one, is that 502 authorized possession of up to an ounce, which is 28 grams, but between 28 and 40, it's still technically a misdemeanor because that exceeds the personal use amount. So again, I don't think that those will have any practical impact.
Hello, and thank you for coming and speaking with us tonight. My concern is that I've recently seen a few of the medical marijuana shops being closed down around the city. And in particular, I'm aware of some individuals that legitimately need the medical marijuana and are under the 21 age threshold. In particular, I'm speaking about Charlotte from Colorado. You may have heard about her. She has seizures consistently. Her parents provided her with medical marijuana and her seizure stopped. Does 502 allow for Charlotte to receive marijuana?
Not 502, but our, you know, the existing medical marijuana law, the Medical Use of Cannabis Act, does allow for a medical authorization, and it creates only an affirmative defense. The production and transfer of that, all of those really remain felonies, frankly, under state and federal law. I think the best hope for the Charlottes of the world is to provide for that product to be provided in the existing 502 system, where you know it'll be tested, it'll be we'll know about its purity, and it'll be, you know, produced in the light of day. And I think that's really the best way to go forward. By the way, let me just mention, I've gotten messages from some of the really conscientious medical providers, and there's many of them out there. And I've gotten messages from them just in the last couple of days saying that they just had three customers in a row were just indignant that they were asked for their medical card, and they said, no one else does, so we won't be coming back here. And what are we going to do to protect those guys when we know so many are just hiding behind a fig leaf of a medical dispensary?
Thank you. Yeah. No. Is that a question? He's asking there.
Okay. It was a rhetorical question.
It was rhetorical.
So I'd like to hear your thoughts on the movement towards an industrial hemp production in this state.
I just one. I'm not qualified, but I heard this explained to me by one of the really interesting cultural phenomenons after 502 passed. In fact, the Seattle Times hosted a wonderful blog about should there be only indoor grows or should there be natural sun-grown marijuana. Mm-hmm. And it was just a wonderful discussion. It was like, you know, wine connoisseurs debating different varieties and regions. I knew that the world had indeed shifted on its axis when I was reading this in the Seattle Times. But one of the points that they've been concerned about is that if you have hemp This plant apparently cross-fertilizes by air very easily, and so you would have recreational THC-driven plants contaminated by hemp farmers. You know, if there's cross-fertilization, then it would mean that the yield, the THC yields on the recreational crops would be negatively impacted. I'm not qualified to answer that, but it's certainly something I think the Liquor Control Board is going to need to address.
Hello. That was actually one of my questions, but the second was perhaps beyond the state jurisdiction, but to what extent is education in high schools and colleges kind of going hand in hand with this, where a lot of people are unsure how to safely use marijuana and to what amount and frequency? And so how much perhaps even research is going along with this initiative, as well as where does, say, once DARE education or alcohol education being kind of met hand in hand with marijuana use education?
I was going to look over to Allison, see if she remembers.
She's on her...
I don't remember that. Well, the short answer is there's not enough research and education going on, and that's because we haven't been getting enough revenue yet to fund those efforts, and, you know, more needs to be done on both fronts. And as more revenues come in, I was just looking at Allison. I can't remember what the earmarked amounts were.
It was 15. So I think it is, I think folks agree it's an important component of this. I think we wish we had more funds for it. Hopefully more funds will become available for it, because it is important. And a lot of folks say marijuana became legal, but there's a lot of uncertainty about some of the details around that or what that means for them, whether that's employment side or driving, you name it. There's all sorts of issues out there that folks have legitimate questions. So I think the hope is to ramp that up as funds become available.
It's one of the downsides of prohibition. There has, you know, because of prohibition, there's been very little meaningful education, very little research, and we've got a lot of catching up to do.
Hi. Excuse me. I'm here as one of the representatives of the Cannabis Law Society at SU, and we're having one of our first general meetings tomorrow for our members, and we told them we would be coming here tonight to report back, so I just... in the beginning, you told us that the marijuana experiment in Washington is going well, but the future is unknown. So what can we tell students to do now and in the future as professionals to support legalized marijuana and our new right?
I mean, it's a thoughtful question. I want to give a thoughtful answer to it because it's a thoughtful question. I'll be kind of curious. Maybe people
as a career possibility? Certainly be informed. Be involved in the legislative process. Understand what's at stake and how things are moving forward both in this state and in comparison to other states, and keep an eye on the federal level.
I think that's a pretty good summary. It's, frankly, I think as any new experiment, you need thoughtful voices that are well-informed, right? There can be a lot of misinformation out there, but also the legislature is making huge decisions, right? They're going to impact one way or the other how this moves forward, right? That they're big decisions. And reasonable folks can disagree on how those decisions get made, right? So this is not fully formed, right? Either through the judicial process, the courts, right, or through the legislative process, or at the local level as well, or with new administrations coming along. I mean, it's a fluid situation is why I often emphasize audiences I speak to about the legalization of marijuana. It's not some static thing. It's very, very fluid in many different ways. So I would encourage them to exactly what Pete said, to be well-informed and active in whatever way they feel appropriate, legislatively, locally, that type of thing. But I think that'd be important.
I also represent the Cannabis Law Society. If anyone on campus does want to go, it's tomorrow at noon in room 109 in Sullivan Hall. My question is more of a two-part question. I realize that there have been a lot of holdups with product and getting recreational shops open. I was wondering if statistics had come back to show that opening the recreational shops are actually doing more benefit for the public than the black market was. I say the black market, but I mean the cash only, you know, smoking in the shadows, so to speak, market. Whether you've seen more turnout to the recreational shops as opposed to people who are buying, you know, from their neighbors.
You know, I haven't. I mean, as far as that initial supply problem, that is a thing of the past right now. In fact, most of the literature suggests there's a glut of product, and prices have really dropped off. It's still difficult for a taxed and regulated system to compete with an unregulated, untaxed system, but it appears the supply has caught up, more than caught up to demand, at least with the approximately 97, 98 stores that are open of the 334 that have been authorized.
My second question was, I'm correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that there was like a bidding system to get stores and to grow, and you had to put your bid in and you would be chosen by the state. In relation to the cash-only market, is there a social justice sort of thing going on where they're reaching out to people who were working in the cash-only community who maybe use this as a living to support their family and maybe get them into the industry to make the whole thing come full circle? Are those kinds of works in the process? Is that something that future, you know, social justice lawyers could work towards?
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure if you've got that on.
I think you're referring to the lottery system that they used. I've gone on record recommending that, you know, for instance, existing medical facilities that are, you know, showing they're trying to comply with the law, they're maintaining their books and the like, should receive some preference for retail licenses. A merit system has been proposed that would, try to identify especially some of the racial disparity questions that we have. And let's try to make sure that we're not perpetuating institutional racism as this industry keeps moving along. I wholeheartedly agree with that. We need some more help. I think it's part of the Liquor Control Board as well, getting its legs, trying to figure this out. Again, this is, don't understate, you know, the phenomenal sea change that has happened here. And that little state agency did an amazing job of building this whole new system from the ground up. And this is one of the big areas that I'm worried about, that we do need to really pay attention, that we're not just allowing wealthy white people to capitalize on this to the exclusion of everyone else.
Okay, to wrap this up, Joni's going to ask one last question about edibles.
So that's the only thing we didn't touch on, and that is, you know, as you know, in the summer, there was quite a bit of trouble out of Colorado. Our stores weren't open yet, but we hurried up and made some, our little agency you just referred to, hurried up and made some emergency regulations, new regulations for packaging and things to prevent your six-year-old twins and many others from getting into edibles. But it seems like maybe we have the right regulations. I haven't heard much about it. Have either of you heard anything that's troubling, or do you think we're about where we need to be?
I'm always careful about saying we're right where we need to be, right? Because it's new information comes along. That said, you're right. Colorado had some huge challenges and really some tragic circumstances out of Colorado on the edible side, right? Not sufficiently describing, for example, how much is an appropriate amount of marijuana to consume with an edible product, right? And so in Washington, one thing I emphasize why going slowly sometimes has its benefits is we've been able to benefit from the experience, for example, of Colorado. This was a really good example of that. The Control Board has put in, I think, some really thoughtful safeguards around that. I think I referenced them earlier, right? Make sure that the packaging, children can't get into the packaging. Those are thoughtful, and the way they describe the amount of marijuana in those products, I think, is appropriate. And Colorado, interestingly, has now asked us for how we're doing it so they can make adjustments, right? So there are always challenges being first. I think we're taking it as thoughtfully as we can, right?
And banned gummy bears, for gosh sakes.
And it's and each one of those can be controversial in its way, and there can be potential litigation around it before we're all said and done, right? So it's a fluid process, but I do think that's an example of where taking a little bit slower and being a bit more thoughtful, I think we've had a bit more success there than Colorado has.
Your thought, Pete?
I agree with what Bob said. You know, one interesting thing in my Denver trip, I'd point out that sodas are going to be a big item. And the producers were grappling with the problem that they could sell one, what would look like a single beer in an aluminum bottle, but it would basically have enough THC to hammer 12 people. And so the idea is you need to obviously give that out in smaller doses, but it looks like a single serving. And their biggest concern was in pricing. Could they charge, because they would charge, I forget the number, but maybe it was $20 for the 10 to 12 serving bottle. And to make it a single serving was going to have to make it about $8 or $9. And so they were worried that people would continue to, the market wouldn't want to buy the more expensive single servings. So I think the market will bear out, that's the ultimate test of this.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for coming tonight and sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, audience. We hope to see you again on May 11th when Dave Reichert and Adam Smith will be here. Good night.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. This event featured Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson and Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes. The moderators were Seattle journalist and host of Civic Cocktail Joni Balter and Seattle University's Institute of Public Service Director Larry Hubble. This event took place at the SU Student Center on January 28, 2015. The next event in this series is Congressional Voices, a conversation with Washington State Representatives Adam Smith and Dave Reichert. That's coming up on Monday, May 11th at 6:30 p.m. in Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium. You can hear a complete version of this event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum, or via your favorite aggregator. If you appreciate the series, please recommend it to your friends. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.